Aloha, welcome to The Conversation. It's Aloha Friday, November 8th. I'm Russell Subiono, in for Catherine Cruz. A more than $4 billion settlement for Maui wildfire survivors was announced back in August, but none of the funds have been paid out. We learn more about the legal issue at the center of the lawsuit that's holding up the money. Speaking of Lahaina, we also have a story about a fire survivor traveling the globe and raising awareness of recovery efforts through running. Our schools are expected to become more tech-focused in the coming years, but does that mean traditional teaching methods are obsolete? We discuss modern trends in education. And we learn more about a new art exhibit featuring work from McKinley High School alumni at the Honolulu Museum of Art. Welcome back to The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Russell Subiono, in for Catherine Cruz. A $4 billion global settlement for victims of the Maui wildfires was announced back in August, but right now it is hanging in the balance because of a lawsuit filed by insurance companies. The Conversation's Maddie Bender has been reporting on the key issue at the heart of the lawsuit, and she joins us now. Morning, Maddie.
Good morning, Russell.
So the settlement was announced like 3 months ago. Why haven't the victims of the fires been paid yet?
Yeah, that is something that I was wondering, which is why I dove into this story. So there is an ongoing legal battle where insurance companies are objecting to the $4 billion global settlement. They are suing the people who put the settlement together, the people who've agreed to it. So that includes the victims of the fires, but also business owners and even HECO, the state. And on Monday, all the parties in this issue filed opening briefs in this case, which has made its way up to the Hawaii Supreme Court. And as part of those opening briefs, actually, the proponents for the settlement released an updated term sheet, which I don't believe had been publicly released before then, so showing the breakdowns of how much each of these organizations, like HECO, like Hawaii Telcom, are slated to dole out if the settlement goes through. So we put together a graphic. You can find that on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org. So proponents of the settlement say this one issue called subrogation is what's holding up the settlement, but insurance companies say actually they have a right to subrogation. The settlement shouldn't go through in the first place. As the settlement's written, it would actually bar the insurance companies from subrogating claims, and that would be unlawful. And this will have big implications either way. If the insurers win, the global settlement will fall apart. And if they don't, it could raise premiums sky high or even make the insurance companies pull out of the market entirely. I spoke with Michael Wara. He's a senior research scholar at the Stanford Woods Institute for the Environment, and he worked on fire and insurance policy in California after the 2017 and 18 wildfires there. He says there's a lot of risk for Hawaii, no matter which way this lawsuit goes.
Hawaii, folks who've been there a long time and have long memories may remember Hurricane Iniki and the challenges for home insurance after that catastrophic hurricane came ashore on Kauai, on the South Shore. And there were real insurance availability challenges after that hurricane. And I think, you know, if you take away the confidence that the insurers have that they can subrogate, that might be a consequence. I'm not saying it would be, but it's a possible consequence. Certainly, if you were to undo the settlement that was reached between HECO and the other defendants in the case and all the plaintiffs, yeah, you know, I don't, if the insurers have a subrogation claim, a claim to recover some of their losses, there's just not enough money.
All right. So earlier you mentioned subrogation. Michael just mentioned subrogation. What is subrogation?
Yeah, I feel like we're going to say this word again and again. So subrogation, it's when an insurance company stands in the shoes of a policyholder to recoup damages it's already paid out. And I thought I would get it, the definition, you know, from the horse's mouth. So I spoke with Aaron Krebs. He's one of the lawyers representing victims in the ongoing lawsuit. His clients want the settlement to go through. And here's how Krebs defines the concept of subrogation.
So subrogation is a legal theory that allows an insurance company to seek reimbursement directly from a tortfeasor to recover money that they've paid to an insured. So, for example, in the Maui wildfire disaster, if an insurance company paid for the value of a home that burned down, they are claiming a right to sue HECO and the other defendants to get their money back.
Tortfeasor is just a legal term that means the person who caused a particular accident or injury. Here's another example that might make sense to people. So imagine you have car insurance and somebody rear-ends you. Your insurance company would cover repairs to your car, and then subrogation lets them sue the person who caused the accident. The insurance company could then recover damages from the person whose fault the accident was up to the amount that it paid you. And insurance companies typically factor in this, that they can get some of the money back in their insurance payouts when they determine things like pricing and premium for their customers. So the current legal dilemma revolves around whether or not they're allowed to sue groups like HECO and Hawaii Telcom when victims of the fires haven't been, quote unquote, made whole, which is a legal term that means compensated entirely for the damages done to them. And the law in Hawaii isn't clear on this. This is something that actually differs between jurisdictions. Here's Mark Grotefeld, one of the lawyers representing a group of 192 property and casualty insurers in the lawsuit. He argues that the global settlement is not only unfair, but unlawful.
There is a term within that proposed settlement that says our clients can't recover a dime. And so long as there's the ability for our clients to collect a dime, then you individual plaintiffs aren't going to get any money from the defendants. That is wrong on so many levels. If those tortfeasors, if these entities want to pay out money to the individual plaintiffs, they should do so. But they shouldn't do it with strings attached. That's wrong. That interferes with the rights of the insurers to pursue recovery on their own accord. And that's all the insurers are looking to do, to be able to preserve their right to seek a recovery, not to interfere with somebody else's. We didn't insert that clause into the terms. We weren't even part of the negotiations when those terms were put together. We didn't even know they existed. So the notion that somehow this is the big bad wolf here are the subrogating insurers is a story that's being told, but it is not the case at all.
Yeah, and so remind us again why this matters, because it really just sounds like a bunch of lawyers being mad at each other.
I think that that is definitely one way to look at it. But if you really think about what they're arguing about, whether or not this global settlement can go through, that is $4 billion. That is a lot of money that would go directly to the people affected by the Maui wildfires. So we're talking property owners, business owners, families, victims, people displaced, harmed, or injured in some other way by the disaster. So I think everybody agrees that it is important they are compensated in some way for the damage done to them. And time is of the essence. It's not just if they get money today versus in a year, it'll be the same. It won't. We've done reporting on housing rebuilding efforts, and time really matters when people are deciding, am I going to try to restart my life here or maybe move away? That's something I've covered. And it especially matters if some of these people haven't received an insurance payout yet. So that was one of the things Krebs said, that by engaging in this lawsuit, the insurance companies aren't just holding up matters for their own policyholders who maybe got a property insurance payout. They're holding up things for people who didn't even have insurance. The longer this drags out, also, the more we need to start thinking about whether HECO will go bankrupt. And bankruptcy proceedings would throw another wrinkle, take even longer to kind of piece apart. And it's pretty clear that the settlement will fall apart if the insurance companies are allowed to sue. So Aaron Krebs, for instance, said that HECO and other defendants are trying to buy peace and they won't come to the table unless they know whatever they pay toward a settlement is one and done.
HECO is not going to pay a dime toward settlement until they know legally they can't be sued anymore. and that they can put their money in the fund and walk away. So that's what's holding up the deal at this point.
All right. So when will this all be resolved?
I wish we knew. That is the question that I think a lot of people are asking. So current lawsuit, people filed these opening briefs on Monday. That started because there was this initial lawsuit the insurance companies filed that was in circuit court. The judge there actually ruled in favor of the people who want the settlement to go through, but then all the parties agreed that there were these three outstanding questions that it would be better if the Supreme Court took a look at and really got to a resolution on what the state law says on the matter. So they passed these three questions on up. Opening briefs have been submitted. The parties have until mid-December each to submit responses. After that, it's pretty likely that the state Supreme Court will schedule oral arguments, and we could expect a decision early next year from there to go back down to the circuit court. So any of the ads that people might be seeing saying they need to speak now and claim part of a settlement, that settlement has not gone through. And right now, it's only just words on paper.
Wow. One more thing for survivors to worry about. Hopefully it gets settled and resolved quickly. But thanks so much, Maddie.
Thank you.
We've been talking to HPR's Maddie Bender about a legal issue that could shape Maui's recovery from last year's devastating wildfires. Look for her stories on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for HPR comes from the Scheidler College of Business at UH Manoa, celebrating 75 years, offering the global MBA with 21-month, 24-month, and 36-month options. Scheidler.hawaii.edu.
Last week on Wait, Wait, Luke Burbank identified the silver lining in the election.
On the plus side, I have made text friends with some very important people.
I'm Peter Sagal. We will offer a wide selection of straws for grasping. Plus, we'll talk to champion ultra runner Tara Dower about escaping on foot. On this week's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me from NPR.
Beginning Saturday morning at 11.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, whose contributors help Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor Anchor Systems Hawaii.
With Lahaina still on our minds, we want to introduce you to someone who hopes to turn tragedy into inspiration, HPR reporter Catherine Kluet-Pakdol, on the line this morning with an uplifting story about a fire survivor. This is so cool, Catherine. Thanks for joining us.
Nate Kahaialii is a fire survivor and a teacher at Lahaina Intermediate School. He's also a runner, and he just completed his sixth marathon on Sunday in the New York City Marathon, and he completed his goal of a time under 4 hours. And he runs with his purpose. As you said, he is from Lahaina, and he wants to raise awareness for Lahaina's fire and recovery efforts as they move forward. He's raising money for Lahaina Strong, as well as just keeping it on people's minds, you know, not forgetting in the midst of everything else that's going on in our lives, what happened in Lahaina. And when the fire hit, he was actually training for the Chicago Marathon. His orange running shoes were among the few things that he grabbed with him when he and his parents evacuated from their Lahaina home. And, you know, in the midst of training, he was thinking he would be back home in a couple of days to grab the rest of his things. Of course, that didn't happen. And now his orange running shoes have taken on a special meaning for him, and he wears them in every marathon that he runs.
The shoes are symbolic, you know, for me of the Lahaina town, for the Lahaina families, for people who lost their homes and loved ones. And that's why on the New York City Marathon, when I was running, I was like saying things like, yeah, Lahaina's with me. It's like Lahaina taking one step at a time. It helped strengthen my purpose of what I'm doing. I'm not running this marathon by myself. The community of Lahaina is running this marathon with me as well, symbolically through the shoes, but like in reality, its own marathon in itself of recovery and healing for the years to come for Lahaina down the line. So it's pretty special to have those shoes and people knowing the story of the shoes. And when they see me wear them, they, you know, I hope they see that that's a symbol of the Lahaina town and the people that call it home.
Wow. And a marathon is such a powerful metaphor for the recovery efforts in Lahaina.
Absolutely. As everyone has been saying, you know, it's not a sprint, it's a marathon. And it's so true for Nate. And, you know, people have been cheering for him as he crosses, you know, the finish line, throwing shakas, shouting out Maui Noko Oi. And he said it's just been really inspiring experience for him. He was one of 26 runners in the New York City Marathon this year selected for Team Inspire, which is made up of runners with powerful stories about why they're running the event. And he was also a panelist along with that on the Citizens stage at the New York City Marathon Expo. And so, you know, he's been able to share his story and people, you know, have started to recognize him and those orange shoes that he wears. You know, as a teacher, he said part of what he hopes to do is to inspire others, and especially his students. In the classroom, he uses marathon running as an example of, you know, physical fitness and setting personal goals that you can reach and work for, as well as advocating for, you know, something that's important to you. And that's such a powerful thing for students to learn, you know, especially middle school students as they're, you know, navigating through all of this. And, you know, he says he makes it fun for his kids. You know, they predict his race time leading up to the race. And he just went back to work today after coming back from New York City. So I know he'll be talking about that in his classroom. And one of the things that he talked about as a teacher was, you know, families moving away. He says he's seen a really big reduction in his class size, which is, you know, concerning as families either have to leave the Lahaina area or move off island, you know, something that we hear about so often. And he just said, you know, whatever can be done to keep Lahaina families in Lahaina, you know, he's here for it and trying to push for that in his marathon running. Kahaialii was born in Arizona, actually, but his dad is from Hawaii and they have a lot of family on Maui. So they moved to Lahaina when he was young and he grew up in that home that they lost in the fire. And he talks about struggling to fit in when they first moved to Maui. And that's kind of how he got started running.
It started really when I moved to Maui. So I was about 6 years old and I had a bit of a culture shock and, you know, I was kind of alone and didn't have any friends. So for fun, I would just start running around the playground by myself. And then these kids would notice me running and then would want to race me. And so running initially was a way for me to gain friends, to socialize. As I grew older, it became more of a competitive thing. And so it's just interesting, like how running has been for me, to gaining friends and feeling accepted, to playing sports. And then really, you know, a couple of years ago, it was a way for me to just kind of challenge myself. It was my friend, actually. I was doing one of my shorter runs and he was running as well. I ran into him and he was the one that suggested about the whole running a marathon and running the New York City Marathon. And he told me about the lottery. And so I just, not thinking much of it, signed up for it. And then a few weeks later, I got the email saying, congratulations, you're running the 2022 TCS New York City Marathon.
So cool. And so what other marathons has he raced since and what's in his future?
Yeah. So as he said, that was this past weekend was his sixth marathon in the New York City Marathon. He's run two in New York City now. He ran the Honolulu Marathon. Chicago Marathon was, again, that first marathon that he ran after the fire. He ran the Tokyo Marathon. And he said he'll be finding out pretty soon in the next month or so whether he was selected for the London Marathon as well as the Berlin Marathon. And so, you know, he's hoping to be able to do those big overseas runs. But he said, you know, regardless of whether he gets into those competitive races, you know, he'll keep running. And he's also thinking of running the Maui Oceanfront Marathon there at home in January. He said a high school student contacted him wanting to do marathon running as their senior project. And so he's going to be helping with mentorship and, you know, maybe training together for that marathon. So that's a cool thing coming up for him. And, you know, as we've heard, mental health after the fire has been critical and something, you know, we probably don't talk about enough, but Kahaialii shares how running really helped him through some of those struggles post-fire.
I don't get depressed all that often, but since the fires, I had a couple of pretty major depressive episodes. And running is kind of like, I want to say it's my escape, but running definitely helps me focus and it helps me put things into perspective. I think the reason why I got depressed was just because, you know, what you know or what you knew was now gone. It's like, you know, the comfort and safety of a home, that's no longer there anymore. And so what the future looks like, I'm like, I don't know, I'm not too sure. And that scared me. And I think that's what got me depressed. And so running helps put things in perspective and not, don't worry about the big picture, but just focus on what's in front of you. And that's very much what running is. It's like, you're not thinking about the finish line. You're just thinking about like the here and now. You're going to get to the end eventually, but just focus on what you can do now. And so I've shared that with my students, especially when we talk about mental and emotional health. I think that's another thing what I like about running is, for me, it has helped ease my anxiety and stress and following that mantra of one day at a time.
Yeah, one day at a time. That's a great mantra to have. What is their current living situation like as they recover from the fire?
Yeah, so he and his parents are in a FEMA direct lease condo in Kihei right now, he said, but they are hoping to move back into Lahaina. You know, so many families, that is their goal sooner rather than later. And so Kahaialii said they're looking into tiny home options. FEMA is, you know, has some options coming up for folks to move into on private property in the meantime while homes are being rebuilt and longer term plans are made. So that's what they're hoping to do. And, you know, as he said, one day at a time.
Well, I hope they're able to get into a place soon. I hope that all of the survivors are able to get there in the near future. But great story, Catherine. Thanks for sharing it with us.
Thanks so much, Russell.
We've been talking to our Maui Nui reporter, Catherine Kluet-Pactel. You can read more of her stories on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. With the presidential election earlier this week, we're testing your knowledge of the first time that Hawaii helped elect a U.S. president, back in 1960. Turnout was high, reaching almost 94% of registered voters as they flexed their newly granted democratic rights. And the margin of the election was razor thin, with our islands helping the Democratic candidate beat his opponent by just 115 votes. For today's backyard quiz, we think it would be too easy to ask you the names of the two presidential candidates that Hawaii voted for. So instead, can you name the two vice presidential candidates that year? Call 808-941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right wins a reusable HPR tote bag.
So
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nareit Hawaii, which supports nonprofits providing affordable housing for formerly homeless families, individuals, and kupuna, such as the Institute for Human Services. NareitHawaii.com.
What will be the dominant trends in education in the future? According to a Forbes article published earlier this year, it's the integration of emerging technologies like virtual reality and augmented reality into classrooms by 2035. With such heavy emphasis on tech in the future, will teachers and students still find value in traditional teaching and learning methods? Stephen Dunn is the head of school at Parker School on Hawaii Island, where they're constructing a new building that aims to balance tech with the arts and athletics. Dunn recently sat down in our studio with me to talk about trends in education. There was a time when school was pretty much, you go to class, listen to the teacher, you read a textbook, you do homework, you take a test, then you move to the next grade and you do the same thing all over again, right? And it seems like things started changing maybe within the last 50 years or so. And now it seems like education has evolved to use a variety of tools and methods to teach students. What do you think is the biggest lesson educators have learned in the last 50 years?
I think it's changed much more probably in the last 15 years. And what we're seeing is that there are methods to do research that weren't available to understand learning and to understand what engages brains, how brains are developing. And I was just having a conversation this morning and was reminded that for some kids, the stand and deliver method that was pretty historic, you know, the sage on the stage is the language that we use in the educational world, still worked for some kids, and they want a pretty dense download of information. For others, we realize that engaging the entire person in the learning process, and that includes their hands and their heart, certainly settles learning and settles information in different ways and sets that perhaps in a more permanent space. I remember from my high school experience, which was about 40 years ago, the things that I still hold today as learning were heavily influenced by the fact that for 2 hours a day, I was in a shop and I was welding and I was doing woodworking, and I was doing animal husbandry. It was an ag mechanics class in South Texas. But I could walk out of the geometry classroom, and I could apply those geometry principles on whatever I was welding or whatever I was cutting. And so I firmly believe that we need those opportunities for our students to really be fully engaged in their learning. Technology is certainly a part of that. Yeah. And, you know, the resources that our students have access to is unbelievable. The challenge, I think, for our students is not getting access to information. Now it's understanding which information to trust and what critical thinking skills do they use to reach those conclusions. They're bombarded with information from every direction from the moment they wake up until the moment they go to sleep. And you know, there's lots of overload.
And it seems like there is such a huge emphasis on tech and education today. Is there still room for just using your hands and your mind and your creativity? For instance, what do you get out of an experience like building a wooden shelf with your hand and tools that you wouldn't get from using a 3D printer to build that shelf?
I think there's such a connection between the tactile and the kind of the intellectual. It could look very simple to say, here's a set of blueprints and I'm just going to cut the board in this way and I'm going to nail it together or I'm going to join it together in some way. But there are so many nuances to what completing that work takes. I think the intellectual challenge in that is, so if we just think about art for a minute, and so it's whether it's drawing or painting or sculpting or pottery or any of those kinds of things, there are thousands of minute decisions that are being made in that process. And students are thinking about, what is it that I want to create? And, you know, they don't completely unplug in doing this, but they certainly get into a zone where technology is not driving the things that they're doing. It may be feeding their thought process or creating a quiet zone for them to do that work. But I think that those creative pursuits are great. When we talk about the skills that we want our students to have as they're heading off to college, risk-taking, creativity, critical thinking, you know, try something and if it fails, move on to the next thing. That happens in art all the time, right? And it feels like, and we can say the same thing about sports, that there's less consequence to making a mistake in those spaces. And we all need that resilience of, yeah, I made a mistake and I can move on and I can own that mistake and keep going. And so where we create those spaces for students to do that, I think that those are the big skills. As we have seen careers change and we've seen maybe technology drive some of those, it's not the technical skills because those are going to change in 5 years. But it is still that critical thinking. How do I know that that's the right thing? How do I know that that information that is being given to me is right? If I think just for a minute about ceramics. So there's clearly skills for you to be able to throw something on a wheel. And I see our students sitting in the ceramic studio, like pot after pot, bowl after bowl, working to get that correct and working on those skills. So the practice and the success of a student finally throwing a good bowl, right, is also a feeling that they won't forget. Probably remember that more than the grade that they receive in an assessment.
I talked to a Little League coach once. Mm-hmm. One thing this Little League coach said to me that I never realized before is one of the lessons that players can learn, athletes can learn from baseball is that there's always another at bat. Mm-hmm. I think that's an important lesson to learn. I think that can be applied to a lot of different areas.
I had a colleague that at a previous school where we were looking at, you know, what are the emerging skills that our students need to have? And at that point, it was long enough ago that we called it 21st century skills. And it was our athletic director that said, all of those skills that we want our students to have are present in every practice and every game when our students step on the field, the court. And I happened to be in town for a volleyball tournament. And as I watched the students on the athletes on the court, they are deep in creativity, right? Deep in problem solving. How are we going to respond to this ball that's just come over the net or this ball that has been spiked over the net? How do we respond to that? And they're putting it all out there, right? They're literally on the floor. They're literally diving after these goals. And if they fail, they jump back up and I see them tap their chest and say, that was me. I made that mistake. That's so much harder for somebody in a classroom to say that. It's brave of them in that moment to say, that was me, I made that mistake, and let's do it again and do it better. Yeah. And so it's those kinds of things. Yeah, there's going to be another serve. There's going to be another at bat. There's going to be another opportunity, and we get to do it again.
I know that you have a history in software development, mm-hmm. and I kind of just wanted to get a sense from you, what is the discussion today amongst educators about the benefits and the pitfalls of AI in education?
My sense is that the conversation is evolving as quickly as AI is evolving, and it is getting better and more powerful with every release of a new large language model by whomever the sponsor is. We're talking about it as a tool. So how do our students understand it as a tool? What are the right times to use it as a tool? What are the right times for you to set it aside and do the work authentically that you're going to need to build your skills in doing? I see it as a great resource for teachers in either the development of materials, the engagement of students, and it's a challenge for teachers because it is moving so fast. Teachers are really busy people, and you know they're teaching 60 or 70 or 80% of their day, and so there's not a lot of R&D time in a teacher's life. And when they're not teaching, they're grading assessments. And so we're trying to find a way that we give our teachers the opportunity to see the possibilities. So how do we give them the professional development and the opportunities to say, I see how this will impact our student learning? We've just started a collaborative process with our neighbors, the Hawaii Preparatory Academy, to ask that very question. You know, what is the future of education in an AI world? Are students prepared for this AI world? And no, our kids are not prepared for that. And because it's moving so quickly, so I think our responsibility is to say, here's this great tool. Let's tell you what it can do. Let's tell you what it can't do. Let's tell you how it does what it does, right? But it's going to take a little bit of time to do that. So we want to make sure that the wave doesn't crest on top of us and we're able to ride it a little bit. But we're a little behind, honestly. I think education is a little bit behind because of the tech community is moving so quickly. We're not paddling quite as fast as they are. but we're all trying to figure it out.
Yeah. The reason I wanted to talk to you today is because your school is building something called the Smart Center.
Mm.
On your website, it's described as 21,000 feet of indoor space, and among the things it will house will be a regulation gym, a technology center, a dance studio, a community kitchen. When it comes to education for the modern student, how does something like the Smart Center fit in with the school's teaching and learning philosophy?
The Smart Center was born out of need. We're a school that is almost 50 years old, and we've never had a home gym. We've had one in the community, and we have a small technology space, and this is going to really quadruple, quintuple the amount of space that we have in there. And we see it actually as a wonderful integration of some of those skills that I was talking about, that we're asking kids to think flexibly in a technology class and to work together to solve problems, whether that's on a robotics team or that's in a class project. And just across the courtyard, there are teams of athletes that are doing exactly the same thing. And so that integration of proximity for this, we feel like is going to be really synergistic. It happens that this competitive space is going to be high school competitive, but it is right next to our lower school, and they're going to take advantage of that space as well. So we see it as a resource for every kid at our school. And that includes not only the athletic space, but some of these design labs and innovation labs are going to be equipped for our youngest students as well. So they get into that space. If we get our kids exposed to that at the very beginning, early in their career, then those skills just get stronger all along the way. And for me, it's experiential, whether it's going to be in those classrooms or whether it's on the slopes of Mauna Kea, that we want them to be experiential and get their bearings in this world and get their bearings in Hawaii. And for us in Waimea, that they have some appreciation of where they are.
You expect the Smart Center to be completed in March of next year. If there's someone out there that would like to support the work that your school is doing or will be able to do with the Smart Center, is there a way for them to support it? Does the school still need a little bit of support for the Smart Center?
Yeah, thank you for asking that. We're really close to finishing the campaign, but we do need a little bit more support. And this has all been funded through private donors, some foundations, but it's been a private process to fund the building. It's going to end up to be about a $20 million project, which is, again, you know, really big for the school. Our advancement office would love to talk to anybody who finds, you know, what we're talking about and what we're hoping to accomplish resonant to them. They can contact the school directly, and we'll make sure that we connect them with the right folks. For our school, we expect it to be really transformational, and we're thankful, so thankful for the support that we received so far to get us to this point.
Stephen, thanks so much for being here this morning.
Russell, thank you so much for the invitation. It's been a pleasure.
That was Parker School's head of school, Stephen Dunn, talking with me about current teaching and learning trends. We'll have a link to more information about the Smart Center on the conversation page of our website after the show. And full disclosure, Parker School is an underwriter of HPR.
Support for HPR comes from the Hawaii Association of Independent Schools, with more than 100 private schools accepting applications now and throughout the current school year. Find a school search at hais.us.
Why do some of us get weepy at weddings and graduations?
Mixed emotions tend to be triggered by pretty emotionally complex situations, like college graduation day, dormitory move-out day, watching the movie Life is Beautiful.
The importance of emotional ambivalence, this week on Hidden Brain from NPR.
Beginning Sunday morning at 11.
And now it's time to count the votes and reveal the answer to today's backyard quiz. Earlier, we took you back to 1960 to the first presidential election in which Hawaii voted, when John F. Kennedy faced off against Richard Nixon. Hawaii was a true battleground state, with the election here coming down to just 115 votes in Kennedy's favor. Nixon, the vice president at the time, certified the results, which gave the electoral votes to Kennedy. Speaking of VPs, we asked you to name the vice presidential candidates of the 1960 presidential election. Those would be Lyndon B. Johnson and Henry Cabot Lodge Jr. And that's today's quiz. If you have one, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. A new exhibit at the Honolulu Museum of Art showcases renowned McKinley High School alumni who shaped modern art in Hawaii over the last century. Seven students and three art teachers are behind the Home of the Tigers exhibit that explores the impact the city's oldest public high school has had on contemporary art in Hawaii. The Conversation's Lillian Song sat down with Imai Kalani Kalahele, class of 1966, a self-taught artist whose work reflects his own personal experiences and Hawaiian identity.
Before I went to the show, I asked you about it, and you told me to just go. The scope of the show was pretty wide. There's different types of art, sculpture, there's painting, there's drawings, and for you, the written word as well. And I experienced so much. It's like, I have to go back.
Yeah, I think just go. I mean, you know, the idea is to experience something. Eh? Unfortunately, this world, art world now, or even for a while, has always been kind of a place where mostly our local people don't go. You know, and that for me is kind of unfortunate because one of the things I want to do with my art is to let people know that this art belongs to them. I used to have a friend of mine, Alapai Hanapi, who used to always say, I'm a people artist. I like that. I think, you know, that's kind of what I like to think that I'm doing. I'm doing the people's art. If something strikes me, you know, if something political happens, or because my politics has a lot to do with my art and my writing, then I'll write something in response to that, develop the idea, and then you know, it would turn into a poem or something. Yeah, and I'm hoping that, you know, people would come away with the fact that this whole idea of contemporary art is really local. And if we look at the expression in this show, you know, we're looking at, you know, over 90 years of experience of art, and it's all contemporary work. Some of these works are like 50, 60 years old, and they're as contemporary now as they were then. You know, and I think that's another important thing for our people to understand, that, you know, this modern expression is really ours also, you know, and we should embrace it and just see and explore what's happening.
You definitely have your own hallmark in the realm of modern art. You do fiber, sculpture, you're a multifaceted artist.
Well, first of all, I'm an unschooled artist. The only education I had in art was really from the academy home up and what I had in high school. The rest of it has really been associating with people and my own curiosity and the need to just make stuff that I haven't seen before. Yeah.
The exhibit was really nicely structured in that it is seven students and three teachers who came out of McKinley High School. When did you go to McKinley, and who were the teachers that influenced you?
I went to McKinley between 61 and 66. I was there for a long time. I had a five-year plan going with McKinley. And my teachers were like Mini Fujita and Charlie Higa towards the end. And they were really influential for me to develop in art. And in music, it was like we had this wonderful teacher, Elvina Nai Kaulili, who was really instrumental in, I think, trying to point us Hawaiians towards a Hawaiian identity and excellence in whatever we do. Yeah, and these were like my really influential people at McKinley.
They were there during your formative years. So you are a teenager, middle of the city, doing your art. You're singing in the chorus, right? while you're doing this, though, you have adults, these teachers around you who are saying, we're going to nurture this talent that you're showing.
Well, actually, you know, my basic discipline was always pen and ink. I mean, you know, because that's what we had. We had pens and paper, and that was about it. You know, pen came later, which, you know, once I started to develop more of a style and a technique and wanting to have it last a little longer than with pencil. Yeah. So I just started drawing, and, you know, drawing was something that I could do. I knew I could draw, and I had wonderful teachers in the beginning who guided us along our way, you know. So I was really lucky to have these teachers.
Mm. Was Minnie with you all the way through? So you started during your sophomore year?
Well, actually, see, I got kicked out of Roosevelt. So my sophomore year was like 2 years. So, yeah, when I first started at McKinley again, I started with her. Okay. With just basic drawing and painting classes. And eventually moved up because she started developing other kinds of art classes. She's, you know, in the beginning, like, she taught ceramics, she taught drawing and painting, she taught advanced painting. She taught the whole art department was her. And yeah, and the irony is that she actually kicked me out of her ceramics class.
Why yeah. was that?
Well, ceramics was just before lunch, and I tended to go surf at about just before lunch. So I used to end up coming in late or not coming in at all.
Attendance was an issue.
Yeah, so she finally kicked me out of the ceramics class, but kept me in her painting class because that one I made.
I see. Well, in this exhibit, when you walk in the doors, you're going to actually see one of your ceramic pieces next to Charlie Higa's ceramic piece.
Well, actually, it came about from the people who were putting the show together. I had just mentioned the fact that I do have a piece from that time. And they looked at it and they said that it was an interesting thing to have a student's piece that actually, you know, came from one of the teachers. So that's how that kind of came about.
You're talking about the co-curators of this show, Alejandra Rojas Silva and Tyler Kahn. Very interesting that they were the ones who actually found that thread of all these McKinley High School artists, either graduates or art teachers that had ties to McKinley High School. And they were the ones who then started curating, putting the pieces together. So when you first saw the exhibit, how did you feel?
Well, first of all, you know, to be in an exhibit with two of my kumus was something for me. It was an honor for me to be exhibiting, especially for those kumu. I mean, they were somebody people in their time, you know, and to be recognized next to them and to actually exhibit with them was a dream of mine for a long time. Thought I'd never make it, but I'm glad because of the show, you know, it happened. Yeah.
So you graduated in the 60s. What was it like being Native Hawaiian during that time?
Actually, there wasn't any. You know, there was no Hawaiian identity stuff going on.
But you said your kumu, your teacher and course.
Yeah, yes.
She helped you.
Yeah. Kau Lili was one that, you know, she was proud to be Hawaiian, and she made sure that all Hawaiians should have that feeling to be proud to be Hawaiian.
Was Hawaiian spoken at home?
No. My mom was Manaleo. She spoke, but she didn't speak to us. My mom, unfortunately, was from that generation that said, there's no use to speak Hawaiian already. Just go ahead and learn haole, be haole. But I think she's changed before she died. And I just really wish that she was like around now when, you know, the whole Hawaiian thing is really blown up. And, you know, we have Hawaiian institutions in the university. We have Hawaiian language being spoken on the radios, TV. You know, we have Hawaiian music has really taken off and really become an entity in itself. So I really wish if she was around now, I think she would have really enjoyed it. Yeah.
When we look at your career or, you know, your path as an artist, how did your writing and your art making mesh? How do they work hand in hand together?
Well, they're sort of one of the same thing. Yeah, me becoming a writer is actually another interesting point because I was never a writer. As a matter of fact, I can't read. If it's not for my wife translating all my work, most of my stuff would never have been made into print. I have a really hard time reading. I have a hard time writing. Mm. I just play guitar. And almost everybody who learned to play guitar, especially when you learn when you're young, has written something. And I used to write these small little ditties. And one day this guy, Joe Velaz, came over the house. And what he wanted was he wanted pen and inks because he was doing a zine. And at that time, it was like Xerox and printer, man. That's all you needed. And a stapler. That's all you needed to be a publisher. He wanted to use some illustrations. So as he was looking through my illustrations, topic got around. He asked me if I wrote. And I said, nah, I just write these small little ditty things, you know. And he said he wanted to see them. So I showed him a couple of what I did. And he looked at me and said, bro, this is not the kind, this is poems. And that's how it actually started. From then on, I started writing. He said he wanted to print a couple of the poems, and he printed it. And I got into that circuit of people who were writing poetry at the time. And that's kind of how I started writing poetry. And since then, I've put out one book of poetry. And I write every once in a great while. Yeah.
You were blessed with that foundation of teachers at McKinley who supported you. And it sounds like as life happened, you had another great support with Eunice, your wife. Mm. Is there something you could read to us to get a feel for what is it that you're thinking about?
Mm. Let me give you just a little part of a poem. Mm. In the beginning, there was a voice. And that voice was Mowgli. And that's something that I really like people to understand, that, you know, there is a Mowgli voice, and that voice belongs here, and it's from this place. And that voice is more than just our voice. That voice goes all the way back to Tahiti. It goes all the way back beyond that from the beginning, because Mowgli just means the first people.
That was visual artist, poet, and activist Imai Kalani Kalahele talking with HPR's Lillian Song. His work is part of the exhibit Home of the Tigers, McKinley High and Modern Art, currently on display at the Honolulu Museum of Art through January 2025. This Sunday, Kalahele will be celebrated at HOMA in a gathering featuring Kanaka Oʻiwi poets and musicians starting at 2 p.m.
I was talking to some friends of mine, and we decided that we understand exactly where their mentality is. They want to be like that.
And that's it for this Aloha Friday. Coming up on Monday, we mark Veterans Day by highlighting StoryCorps' military voices. Call our talkback line and leave us your comments. That's 808-792-8217 or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can also listen back to our shows on the conversation page on the HPR website or Spotify, Apple, or anywhere you tune in for podcasts. Our program is produced by myself, Lillian Song, and Maddie Bender, with support from Savannah Harriman-Pote and Tori Desjardins. The Backyard Quiz theme was written for us by John DeMello, and our theme music courtesy of Gypsy 808. I'm Russell Subiono. Join us Monday and pick up the conversation. ¶¶